plasma microwave background radiation since its inception, I believe.
Yeah, sure.
And he's been here before to report on results from WMAP. He was here to tell us about the three-year results. And now he's going to describe the new results in the enlarged data set with 5 years worth of data.
Well, hi. There's the spacecraft, as the picture says, it's just up and spinning, and it seems to be working just perfectly, which is kind of fun because it's too far away to fix. So we've had one. I just skipped to the update of the instrument because it's sort of boring. We've had one hardware failure in the now six and a bit years of flight, that a section on our battery failed. But it was a kind of surplus battery because we were in the sun all the time. And so what that meant is we run at a lower voltage and the temperatures are lower and the instrument works better. And other than that, we've had quite good luck with the hardware. So here's the science team, which has grown a bit. It started out with 12 of us actually building the instrument, and then it turns out it's a huge amount of effort to analyze the data. And our approach has been, I know we get complaints for being slow, but our approach has been we get the data out as fast as we can to the public and put the data out and our full likelihood codes and the time series and everything. And so a big fraction of the of our effort is just getting the data to the point that we're sure enough of it that we release it to everybody. And that took more effort than those of us building the instrument thought it would. So here the team is growing. I should say a thing about Chuck Bennett. I've been on a bunch of projects. He's just a perfect PI. I have no idea that there's ever any hassle with any administrative stuff between us and NASA. So he just seems to completely absorb that and protect the team and leave us to be functional. And I should say a word here about David Wilkinson, who really inspired all of this. The WMAP approach to building a clean instrument with stuff you already know how to do and get it flying fast and I'm not sure quite what the right word for it is, but let your systematic error budget and techniques that you already know how to do completely drive everything else. It was the inspiration of the whole project. Sadly, he died just before the first results came out, and so he was the type of guy who would never put his name on a paper he hadn't made substantial contributions to, and certainly not that he hadn't read. So the team knew that he would not have let us put his name on those papers if he was dead, so we named the satellite after him, which was the only way. And we had a moment of fear, I should say, when we suggested to NASA that they rename the microwave anisotropy probe, the Wilkinson microwave anisotropy probe. We had a moment's fear that NASA would take this as open season on names on our satellite and think of what they like, but that didn't happen. Let me start, just because what we're doing is we're looking at the microwave background and we're inferring from it stuff we see way earlier. And because this isn't mostly, even for an astrophysics audience, I need to go through this reminder. I just want to walk through. This is not WMAP results. This is stuff we did in 1990 with a sounding rocket. So it's a sort of pedagogic example. If you look anywhere in the sky, the brightest thing in the sky is the cosmic microwave background. And so here's the spectrum of it. Taken really just looking anywhere, the way we chose what spot to look at is this spot was overhead at midnight the day we flew our rocket. So you just point, you fly, you look at the sky, and that. Oh, okay, I should apologize for these spectroscopist's units here. The horizontal axis 5, 10, 15 is 1 over the wavelength in non-SI units here of centimeters. So 10 means a wavelength of a millimeter, and 5 is a wavelength of 2 millimeters. And this is just how bright the sky is, no correction for any foregrounds. And it is a thermal curve, 2.7. We looked at a spot which is a few millikelvin brighter than the average. So the real temperature of the sky is 7.28 or something Kelvin. 2.728 or so Kelvin. Here's this beautiful fit to a black body curve, which is the thermal radiation in the universe when it became, well, in the universe today, which arises from the universe being a few thousand degrees at a redshift of a bit over 1,000 when it became transparent in early days. What I'd like to ask is, what ethic are you studying by measuring that the thing fits a blackbody curve so well? So the most simple-minded answer is, the universe was opaque early on. It became transparent when it had cooled to a few thousand degrees. It was 380,000 years old. That's the epoch we're looking at. And what we look is, anywhere in the sky, you see some place far enough away so that you're seeing it as it was long ago, and it was a few thousand degrees, and that's what you're looking at. But clearly, this blackbody curve needed to be established at some point earlier than the moment you saw it. So really, really, the epoch you probe by measuring the spectrum must be the epoch at which that blackbody curve could last have been established. The fact that it's such a smooth curve, let me just flip back, sorry for taking so long on one graph. The fact that it's such a smooth curve means that the universe we're looking at the moment it became transparent, is in thermal equilibrium. If there was, if it weren't, then there would be some distortion of the spectrum. So when could that equilibrium have last been established? And so here's a kind of complicated graph, if you haven't seen these before, where there's time on this axis, scale on this axis, and what's plotted is various reaction times and so on. So the heavy line is age of the universe, plotted here as a function of, so this is 1 plus the redshift. So that means the universe is larger now than it was at some time by a factor of this, right? So the universe is larger now than it was at this time, but by a factor of a million. Just how to read the graph. So here's the age of the universe as a function of how much it's expanded since the universe was each of these ages. And there are various processes. Photons, photons can scatter off of baryons, and baryons can scatter off of photons. Baryons scattering off of photons have a faster reaction time because there are more photons. So it's easier for a baryon to find a photon than for a photon to find a baryon. So the photons scattering off baryons have a longer reaction time. And here's the process where the universe becomes transparent. When it starts getting close, that the time it takes for a photon to scatter off of a baryon is comparable to the age of the universe, it'll scatter, but it won't find one next time. And so somewhere in here, photons stop scattering. What I mean when I say the universe is transparent is the time it takes for one of these microwave background photons to find a baryon and scatter off of it is longer than age of the universe. So it just comes to us without finding something. So this is the process in which that scattering, photons scattering off of charged particles, stops, the universe becomes transparent, and that's the epoch at which we're looking at this microwave background. But the important point is, none of these, Compton scattering, or these, Thompson scattering, change the number of photons. So if one of these, if particles had some different amount of energy in it than light did, this kind of scattering could, on average, give energy to the microwave background spectrum, or take it away, depending on whether photons or matter had more energy, but wouldn't change the number of photons, and therefore wouldn't give me a new thermal spectrum. It would just take that spectrum and move it to the right or to the left, and not thermalize it. So the processes on here, double Compton scattering and Bremsstrahlung, are the processes which change the number of photons. To get a new thermal curve when you inject energy, you need to transmit the energy to the photons and change the number of them. So here's the epoch, 10 to the 5 seconds or so, when the universe became thermalized. That's the last moment in this picture that that thermal curve could have been established. So that experiment, you point a thing at the sky, you measure the energy distribution, you find the thermal curve, probes that there's not been any big energy releases in the universe since it was a week old. I mean, this is now kind of old news, but I'm just sort of walking you through that although we're looking at a surface of the universe when it was a few hundred thousand years old, routine to probe times way earlier than that, when you ask what the dynamics of the processes are. And so there's this funny thing for most of the particles in the universe, which are, after all, photons. Nothing has happened since the first. I mean, really nothing at all has happened since the first week or so. There's some other times I should put on here. So Bremsstrahlung stops being important when the universe is a second. I think it's a coincidence, but we'll get to it. Neutrinos also stop scattering about then. So there should be, just like when the universe becomes transparent to photons, they're still here, they're just not coupled anymore. The universe became transparent to neutrinos early on, age of about a second. They're still here, they're just not coupled anymore. And there's a background in neutrinos, which, well, okay, if nothing else happened, it would be 2.7 Kelvin like the light. It expands and cools the way, you know, relativistic particles do. And so there wouldn't be a temperature difference, and you would expect the neutrino background to be 2.7 Kelvin. But when electrons and positrons freeze out in here, when the temperatures are parts of a half an MeV or so, then the photon fluid can be reheated. When does that happen? That happens in here. Temperatures are part of an MeV. You lose degrees of freedom for there being electrons and positrons. It's still early enough that that can be thermalized, and it is. And so the photon bath is reheated. So the photons are 2.7 Kelvin, and we expect the neutrinos to be a bit under 2 Kelvin and pervasive. Okay. Well, so here, just to walk you through the full suite of what we've released. We released descriptions of our data processing and so forth. A source catalog, which is kind of fun, except that with our big, huge beams, these sources are all famous and people with real telescopes. You know, this is just a satellite, so our telescope is this big and is light enough that you can hold it really with one hand. So people with real telescopes study, find these things honking bright, and they all have names, even if they're faint for us. And we released two papers which go through the likelihood of what the cosmological parameters are. This one by Dunkley is just from our data, and the one by Komatsu is combining our data with everybody else's. And I'd like to get to those. Oh, and I should say, there's an explanatory supplement, and all of our data are out available. So if you think you can do better at analysis, there it is. And I should say, typically, I mean, the community is pretty inventive, and a lot of the best analysis is not done by the team, which is kind of fun. So what's the difference, 3 years, 5 years to 3 years? One difference, I should say, is the main result, this anisotropy of the microwave background, the model predicts a variance on the sky. So we really are measuring a variance. And your precision in the variance grows linearly in time, not as the square root of time. So that's it's a nice regime to be in if the thing you're measuring is a variance instead of a number. And so for a bunch of the data which we determine, you know, every year counts. Here we're not into the square root of time regime at all. The other thing is we've spent a bunch of our added precision and sensitivity understanding our own instrument better. We've reached the point now where nearly nothing we measured before flight is involved in the analysis. We need to know our beams really well, and I'll get to that in a moment. But you know, here on ground, we test our telescopes in air and warm and with gravity. And they're operating not in air and no gravity and cold. So they are just different. And we worked pretty hard measuring our telescopes on the ground. But what we need to know, we really have gotten from the flight. And that's been a huge difference. So I think this thing, a better beam characterization, which we've done in flight, is the really big deal. And so now here's the really, if you want just to know what we've done and go back to sleep, then here it is. It turns out that the early universe can be described by a really simple six-parameter model, which is called lambda CDM. That is, there's a cosmological constant, and there's cold dark matter. So the model in rough terms is 70% of the energy is in this thing called dark energy. The rest is matter, but 90% of matter is not atoms, but some other kind of dark matter. This picture holds really well. Early on, we tried some other things of what if we add a kind of tilted spectral index not called for by the models, but sort of hinted at in the data. The evidence for that has gone away, more or less. There was more room that neutrinos would have a mass, and that seems to have gone away. Sudden reionization is rejected. This is the universe just seems to be the simplest thing you could picture, and consistent with what the rest of what we know from astrophysics. The thing which is new this time, and I should say it, is although it's not a surprise, right? There is this neutrino background, has to be. This is the first data set where it's independent, you know, it's not really 3 sigma, 2.9 sigma or something like that. No neutrino background is not a good fit to our data. This is, I think, the first almost detection. It's the first experiment I know of where zero likelihood for the cosmic neutrino background isn't the best fit. So I'll walk through individually the papers, but I think this audience mostly won't be interested in the point source thing. So we have a catalog of point sources. As I say, it's complete to 2 Janskys. So a Jansky is a 10 to the minus 26 watts per hertz per square meter. It's a point source intensity thing. These are honking bright things, and they all have names. All 290 of these things are known to the astronomical community very well. There were some things in our 3-year catalog which didn't have names, and they don't make the cut anymore, so they must have been nice spikes. Our sources are mildly polarized, and many of them are variable. So here's a bunch of, this is just different channels of ours looking at a point source as a function of when we saw it. Our satellite is out, you know, past the moon, looking at the sky. It looks away. It sees dark sky only, but it's still in our galaxy, which is a foreground to the microwave background, and we need to remove it pretty well. There's a whole separate community which is fascinated about with our galaxy. So for them, what it is we remove is a separate data product. But from the cosmology point of view, we just would like to know. We can recognize galactic emission and remove it, and that there's a part of the map which is clean. And so what we do is fit. So I'm just explaining here. We have a model which says there's synchrotron and free emission. There's thermal dust. The synchrotron has a slope, and the dust has a slope. So we have a number of different emission mechanisms. For each pixel, we make a fit to. So this just is a. You know, these are likelihood contours. For these fits, you see we don't constrain the thermal dust spectral index practically at all. But just the same, then armed with these fits, this is for one pixel. I've just chosen arbitrarily to plot. We do this for every pixel, fit to these foreground parameters. And the result then is a calculable foreground emission model. CMB is not one of these, right? Then the extra parameter is what's the brightness of the CMB. And so here, we end up doing that fit for each pixel and then getting a model which you then have to choose a frequency to express it. But anyway, so here's synchrotron and free, and the dust. So these are expressed at our longest channel where they're bright, and this is dust, the dust amplitude. Again, these are always in millikelvin. At our shortest channel where it's brightest. And this is a plot of the signal to noise ratio of the residuals. So that's the map minus these foregrounds minus the CMB. And so the process works. And the other point is that for 85% of the sky, we have a clean map. This middle part, we just mask out where the galaxy, see where the galaxy is just insanely bright. And so we mask that out. And the other 85% of the sky is clean for CMB analysis. I maybe just point out, this looks a little speckled. So where we recognize a source, or where we have catalogs which say there are sources which we ought to have recognized and they are really bright, we just poke holes in our mask. So the mask is defined by a certain brightness in the longest wavelength band or catalog membership. And we analyze for everywhere else. So here are the maps of the sky. I haven't tried as a gag on myself to replace this with the first year maps and see if I can tell the difference. But it's hard. Because the signal noise ratio right out of the box was pretty high here. The thing to look at, so these are just these are sketched out in wavelength. So that's 90 gigahertz, 90, 60, 40, 30, 24. So obviously the longest wavelength band has a lot of galactic emission, and there's less and less. Actually, this probably 60, oh, I had them wrong. Sorry, the 60 gigahertz channel probably has the least total contamination. But the thing to notice on these is the color scheme is chosen so that the CMB is equally bright in any of these channels. That is, these are in brightness of a Planck curve whose temperature is 2.7 Kelvin. So any structures which look just the same in all of the maps are the CMB. So, I mean, if I look at, you know, at this thing or that or, you know, who cares what, I see that. Well, this guy's getting a little hard, but I see it here. So things which are the same in all these maps are the microwave background. And these are brightness fluctuations. This is now microkelvin, right? So these are brightness fluctuations of the sky of, you know, 30 or 100 microkelvin. And they're the brightest thing in the sky. It's just lucky for us, I think, lucky for humans doing this, that we live in a place where the sky is so quiet that this light from the start is the brightest thing by such a huge factor. Right, the microwave background itself is 3 Kelvin. So we are really looking for parts in 10 to the fifth or so of it, and even these parts in 10 to the fifth of the microwave background are brighter than anything else on the sky. Just a gift. Well, okay, it's crucial for us that we measure polarization, and we do it in an awkward way, I should say. So if you want to do this experiment again, we have, it's a beautiful experiment in lots of ways, but it wasn't really designed to be the perfect polarimeter. It's a differential instrument, so we have two telescopes. People memorize this thing that was on the first slide. So we have two telescopes, and they're looking off like this. Every feed horn is polarization sensitive, and so we've set our polarization angles to be, if I'm taking a difference, I'm taking a difference of two parallel polarizations, and what happens is, when I take this difference, and later the spacecraft is rotating, and I take this difference, you see that it's the opposite diagonal strength. So comparing those, I measure the diagonal polarization brightness difference in that direction. Seems fine. The trouble is, I'm comparing any polarization measurement as a difference of two brightness measurements. That is, brightness polarized this way minus brightness polarized that way. I'm taking the difference on a time scale of a minute or 30 seconds because our spacecraft needs to have turned around, and we're wobbling, so it doesn't actually really even point to the same place. So we take these differences only after making a map, and we really are taking brightness differences to measure polarization on kind of intermediate time scales between 30 seconds and part of an hour, depending on how what you think of our map convergence. You'd like to have that be really fast to cancel out drifts and stuff in the instrument. And the polarization signals, there's a certain hierarchy here. The brightness is Kelvin, the anisotropy signals we're looking at are microkelvin, and the polarization signals we would like to be searching for are nanokelvin. So this is not the cat's pajamas for polarization instruments, but by any means. Maybe this is out of order if I haven't talked about fitting parameters, but let me just try anyway. I'd like to motivate why we're working so hard to measure our beam size. And the basic thing is, one of the, well here, so I haven't shown a measured spectrum yet. This is the variance of the sky as a function of multiple number. So let's just think of this as the world's worst E&M homework problem. I gave my E&M quiz final exam last night, and this was not on it. Take this temperature field and express it in spherical harmonics. And so it's a perfectly fine problem, and the first spherical harmonic is the L equals zero. It's a constant term, and then there's three L equals one dipole terms, and then there are five L equals two, and so on, and you go on like that, and I'd like to go, there's two L plus one terms at L of, you know, at any given L. I can't even write them down after a while, and I'd like to go out to L of a few thousand. And what the model predicts is that at a given L, the 2L plus 1 modes are chosen to have zero mean and have a variance given by the model. So what this graph is the variance of the 2L plus 1 modes at each L, plotted against L, out to L of a few thousand. Obviously, somewhere you stop writing these down as cosines and sines and just make up a recursion relation and go for it. I guess I should, because it's not a mostly astronomy audience, let me either explain or remind you what's going on here. The universe, well, early days in the universe, you can't really fall towards an object you haven't seen yet. You have no evidence that there's a massive, you know, imagine there was some very massive thing that I would like to fall towards. But the universe is young, and the speed of light is only, you know, not very fast. So no information has gotten to me yet that there's a massive object there. So I don't expect early on big things to start to collapse, but littler things will. So I expect little structures to collapse first. They collapse, they get hot, the heat drives the baryons out, the thing oscillates. I should expect acoustics to happen driven by an initial gravitational collapse. Little things bounce and, you know, collapse, get hot, expand, cool, collapse again, and bounce a few times. The photons leak out of that process. So would neutrinos, other things that aren't so coupled, but the light and baryons would continue to oscillate. Bigger things start later, way bigger things start even later, and then poof, the universe becomes transparent. And there will be hot and cold places, and there will be dense and underdense places, which is just a snapshot of how was this acoustics going at the moment the universe became transparent. And so this is the scale at which the largest structures just had time to collapse and be objects of big variance. Then this is a scale where the structures slightly larger had time to collapse and re-expand. Collapse, re-expand, collapse. These are all smaller and smaller things with more and more, faster and faster response time. So in 380,000 years, this could collapse, that could collapse, re-expand, collapse, re-expand, collapse, collapse, re-expand, collapse, re-expand, so on. So I expect these, and I expect there to be less and less power out here. And I expect all of this to be essentially processing on some initial underlying power spectrum, which was put there at the start. And if I want to study the start, I would love to unscramble those ripples and ask, what's the initial underlying power spectrum? That's the real physics of what happened in the moment of inflation. It's also true, and we'll get to that in a moment, maybe. Oh, well, maybe we won't. So I'll say it here. The more baryons there are, the more this is driven down. So the relative heights of these peaks tell us the amount of baryons compared to the amount of total matter. So I would like to know really the heights of each of these peaks as well as I can know them. And I would like to know the slope of some underlying spectrum that governs the whole thing. And what I want to point out here is, here's the Fourier transform of a nominal single experiments telescope beam. If I knew the forward gain of the telescope to 1%. And the difference between these completely masks this. Here, this is there are three curves plotted here. Can people even see that there's a green one? From where I'm standing, the screen doesn't look that bright. I see three. I plotted three curves here for a spectral index of 0.96, 0.98, and 1. And the thing to point out is that knowing your beam to a percent is required to even be discussing what these spectral indices are. And it's this spectral index, and these are sort of realistic numbers. We think the spectral index is more like 0.96 than 1. That kind of difference is the thing that allows us to time the dynamics of inflation at the very earliest times. So that knowing our beams to high precision, just absolutely required. I gotta say, knowing your total beam to 1% is about 10 times better than any earthbound telescope I'm aware of has done. We really, this is new for astronomy. What we do is we look at Jupiter. So this is Jupiter measured. And here's a model, and here's the difference. We're lucky here in a way. The first year we looked at Jupiter, there was this pesky microwave background behind it, which we didn't yet have good maps of. And so we only could measure Jupiter down to the level in our side lobes where it's as bright as the microwave background. But Jupiter moves. So every time we see it, it's in a new place. And except for after the first year, it's in a place where we've already mapped the microwave background. So now we're getting clean measurements of Jupiter twice a year. And then this code, I should say a word about. We have a physical model with a few hundred Zernike polynomials of the shape of our telescopes. We propagate an electromagnetic field from our feed horns to the secondary, to the primary, out to space, and we fit those models to these Jupiter observations. So one run of this model takes about a month. Figure of merit here is, can you analyze your data faster than you can collect it? And since this is 5 years of data, we have lots of months. But this is a calculationally difficult problem. Not, I should say, the hardest problem I can think of. The guy who started this work, Chris Burns, left and took a job working for Microsoft fixing security problems. So I think this is easier. So just the same, there's a cluster at NASA Goddard devoted to this, which just does nothing but runs these models. And that gives us, there's a hierarchy. The middle part of our beam, Jupiter, is bright. We just measure it. That's the beam shape. And then the sort of middle range, these models allow us to calculate a Fourier transform of our beam, which is what we need. And then at big angles, it turns out we kind of spun and looked at the moon as we went by on the way out. So we measure the far side lobes. This is our three-year error bars. This is the difference between what we thought our beams were and what we now think they are. And our new error bars are about half of those red ones. I realize I've taken too much time, and I would like to get to a bit more of the physics. So here, as I say, here's our spectrum. These error bars are what we are binned values, but at each L by L, we get these dots, this little cloud. So I should explain what I mean by cosmic variance limited. So the model says the sky should have zero mean, and at L of 100, there are 201 modes, and their variance is this big, whatever, right? But the thing is, we live in some actual universe. And we don't get to see an infinite number of modes at L of 100. We just get to see all of the sky that you can see from here. And so we expect L by L that there's a certain variance that just comes about from perfectly measuring our whole sky. Right? I mean, let me walk through this at lower numbers, right? So at L of 10, there are 21 terms. If I measured all 21 terms exactly and there were no galaxy in the way and no noise, then I could take the variance of those 21 numbers. But that would reflect the true underlying variance only with a precision plus or minus 1 over square root of 21. Because that's how, I mean, if I have n numbers, that's how well I can determine the variance of them. So there's a variance that just comes about from perfect measurement of the sky, and it describes our data out to L of 530. So somewhere in here. Below that, this scatter in these points is just given by perfect measurement of the whole sky. And so this experiment, from here over, the experiment's finished. Anybody does this again, they will get not this red curve, but they'll get each of those little black dots, which have essentially no error bars on them. And out here, there's still, of course, room for improvement. And so again, the fact that this guy doesn't lie on that smooth interpolation up in here tells us that that we live in a universe that's not dominated by baryons, atoms, but is mostly dark matter. The matter term in our universe is mostly not matter that interacts with light or with electric charge. Well, here, just to walk through, other people have done this experiment, and in particular, our telescope quits in about here, just because it's only a certain size, and so it's hard for us to get great angular resolution. So you can build big telescopes on the ground, several meters across, and repeat these measurements, and the agreement is great. And let me just show, if I put this on a, this is a kind of funny graph, actually, so this is L to the 1/4, not quite, it looks sort of pseudo-logarithmic, but it isn't. So if I plot on a log scale the higher end here, so this is still the first peak, second peak, third peak, but this displays more of the data. So here's only these small angular scale experiments, probably the most influential of which is ACBAR, which is at the South Pole. And the thing, so the red line is just a fit to our data alone. So I would say the agreement is great, and in fact, the tension is nothing. That is, the blue points here wouldn't push us to change parameters that led to this red curve. So it adds a bit of constraining power, but less than you might have thought, since the model seems to work so incredibly well. And so it's almost gotten boring. We fit the model, that power spectrum to a model of how many baryons are there, how much cold dark matter is there, what's the probability that a photon has scattered since the moment the universe became transparent. This scattering happens. The universe is now largely ions. It's not mostly full of neutral gas. And the reason is there are stars, and the stars give off optical and UV, and that ionizes stuff. And so we measure that there's an 8 or 9% chance that microwave background photons have scattered during the epoch when stars first formed. The underlying spectral index, this is the key to details of inflation, and the question is whether or not this is consistent with 1, which would be inflation having run forever, or is this less than 1? This is a normalization constant for the height of the total overall power spectrum, and here's the energy density and the cosmological constant. And the thing to notice, so in every curve, here's the 3-year result and there's the 2-year result, and the sensitivity is better, and not by root 5/3, but more like, 5/3, or in some cases even more. So it's consistent and the precision is growing. And I mean, I can't help but being just, this was our goal, and it was sort of depressing mildly to succeed. It's a simple model, and there's just kind of nothing to tease at here. And these are perfectly reasonable parameters, and they're completely consistent with everything else in astrophysics. So the fun's got out of this game a bit for me. Wonderful as it is, and it's kind of fun to do an experiment which does what you meant for it to do. And it's kind of funny to say how bored you are. This is, after all, the universe. So it should be, people measure specific heats of things and so forth, and they get a numerical answer, and the answer's precise, and they're happy. So I should be happy measuring properties of the universe, because it is, after all, an interesting object. But here, I've left out a bit about how could this possibly have begun, and so let me just quickly, because this is walk through what I mean when I say we're testing inflation. I've left out a bit. If I say the universe started and expanded and cooled and became transparent at some point, and we measure it, then if we think for a moment in that picture, that there's some spot over there 14 billion light years away, and some spot over here 14 billion light years away, that each became transparent when the universe was 380,000 years old. Who synchronized them? I mean, what's happening that they were the same physical temperature at the same distance, so that when I look at those two places, they have exactly the same apparent temperature to this complete, huge, high precision. So I'm missing a phase here. This is called the horizon problem, that coupled these various parts in the universe. Any place, if I hold my thumb up about like this, and I look at any two spots on the sky, which are separated by more than about that distance, in the naive picture of, you know, infinite density expanding, cooling, becoming transparent 380,000 years, any places separated by more than my thumb have never communicated. So we're missing the, what were they doing before that let them communicate? And so one, the only, I think, attractive solution for that is a thing called inflation, perfectly allowed, just like we live now with a cosmological constant, which in the right units is 10 to the minus 120. And that causes an accelerated expansion. There could have been other values, and there could, GR perfectly allows exponential expansion. If you choose the physical constants wrong so that you end up with a pressure in empty space, then off you go. And so the thing to picture is that the universe is bubbling along, minding its own business, more or less stable, and then some little part of it expands for a tiny amount of time, say, you know, a few times 10 minus 35 seconds, expands by maybe 60 orders of magnitude. And that takes regions which were in perfectly good thermal contact and puts them unbelievably far apart from each other. They're then kind of frozen. They're so far apart they don't see each other anymore. They're not causing anything to happen until the horizon, which is just growing linearly with time. As that grows and they then, after inflation, first see each other, they'll begin to fall and so forth. And so what this does is put structures into the early universe, which are then correlated. And the game here is to try to tease out how this really happened. When this was first proposed, it was also known, so to speak, that the proton wasn't stable, and that this would be the same phase transition, and life would be simple, and we would solve these two problems at once. That seems to have gone away. But the thought is, there must be some important particle physics phase transition which happened early on, which we can explore here. The predictions are, universe is nearly spatially flat. That just means it's really big. You know, if I think of a sphere and I just blow it up and we're only exploring now some tiny little bit of it, the part we're exploring is flat compared to the whole thing. The fluctuations are Gaussian, they're adiabatic, which is essentially thermalizing late in that expanding part. They're almost scale invariant. That is, spectral index of 1 is the stable point if that inflation runs forever. And so I expect a spectral index which is less than 1, closer and closer to 1 the more time you spend inflation, the more e-foldings there were. And that there should be a modest level of gravitational radiation which we should be able eventually to detect. And the radiation, the gravitational radiation, the universe is instantaneously, if there's gravitational radiation present, the universe is instantaneously transparent to it. So it decouples when it happens. And the thought is that's a sort of residual wrinkles and stresses in the shape of the metric at the end of inflation. So this should be a real sign, if you could see it, of exactly how that last little curvature in here looked. Flat. The CMB can't establish flatness alone, because we don't have a distance scale along with whatever else. But anything else that provides a distance scale does establish that the universe is flat. So I've just plotted, if the six parameters, well, this is a seventh parameter. Sorry. So the six parameters were assuming the universe was flat. If I allow that there's an energy density, either I could say missing or an energy density stored in curvature, and I fit for that along with everything else. So here's the energy density and the cosmological constant. Microwave background alone, perfectly happy with quite a bit of curvature, and then not 0.7, but 0.2 or 0.4 of the energy density in the cosmological constant. This is color-coded, just to guide your eye, for Hubble's constant. So if you measure how fast the universe is expanding today, you get this value, and that the curvature is zero in cartoon form. So all I'm saying is, I need a distance scale too. And then I can constrain the total curvature. We did not use Hubble's constant. It's hard to measure. So there's a bunch of things that are surprisingly easier. Look at density fluctuations in galaxies. There's a thing which has come to be called baryon acoustic oscillations. I'd like to point out the microwave background are also baryon acoustic oscillations, but if you say to astronomers, I'm measuring baryon acoustic oscillations, you don't mean those ripples I showed you in the microwave background, but instead acoustics in where galaxies formed. This is a reasonably well understood theory, and that spacing sets a distance scale to galaxies at modest redshift. So the redshifts are given here. It's also true that supernovae, which are thought to be, if you look at how quickly the brightness rises on a supernova, you should be able to understand its absolute brightness. We chuck out any belief that you know the absolute brightness, but say, well, at least they get the scale. That is, a thing which is twice as far should be, a quarter as bright. So we get a distance scale also from fitting a model to the supernovae data. Either one of those gives us a distance scale. And then the result is, if I go back to this plot, here's the microwave background alone, there's the microwave background with baryon oscillations added in. So here's baryon oscillations at supernovae. Baryon oscillations do a little better because we take an absolute scale from them. But here, the energy density in non-flatness is a few percent at most. Right? This is a tenth, so that's 2%, and this thing is it's about 1% in width. So if I walk through the predictions of inflation, that's good.
Mark,
yeah.
Before you go on, can you go back to slides?
Two slides.
I'm staring at this thing.
Thinking that's not the world's best fit.
That is terrible.
Exactly. Yeah.
Find yourself.
Yeah, you think this might pull down a bit, right?
I think that pulls down. I think you have a point and a half, which is 4 or 5 sigma away from the red line.
Oh, no, I don't have a lot of freedom on this red line. Yeah, so this pulls it up. So that guy's got a smaller error bar. I'm just fitting a line like this that looks to the data. I can't. If you want to tell me that supernovae happen in stars and stars are complicated and maybe I don't have the story completely straight, and wouldn't you like some other data set besides stars, I'm all with you. But if you ask, is the net...
I guess what I'm really asking is, as bad as this fit is, and as far away in terms of standard deviations as some of these points are...
Chi-squared for this fit is horrendous.
Given that, why would I trust the uncertainty that results from adding this data to your fit?
Oh yeah, so let's not. that's this curve here, right? And it's this one that, from the baryons, where I really get an absolute distance. So isn't it surprising, bad as those data are, that they anyhow got about the right answer? I'm not a big fan of supernovae. I think they're complicated. Mike. Here, one. Six plus one. Oh, that's why I'm saying one. We're only using this to get a distance. So there's one parameter.
One parameter.
That is, let's say I know everything about the universe from the microwave background, except I don't really know how far away that surface is. So I'm gonna use this to constrain the one thing I don't know. Really what I'm doing is I could be anywhere on that line, and I just want to know where. And so I'm using that to pick up one more parameter. And I agree, the data look really ratty. And the conjecture that all supernovae are the same, and if you measure their rise time, then you know everything about them, will fall apart the more we know about supernovae.
So they're not a standard candle.
They're really, really good standard candle. but that's getting to be not good enough. Whoa, I'm out of time. So look, I've done this before, and I apologize. It's actually interesting that we only... that the universe is only Gaussian at kind of one sigma level here. And there is a prediction that it should be non-Gaussian. And so there are people who do these calculations, let me say, wrong with our data, and get a two sigma detection, if you could call a two sigma thing a detection, of non-Gaussianity, and they're all excited. But so far the sky does look pretty Gaussian. I would like to get on. I would like to get on to things that particle people might more understand. The claim is that the universe ought to be adiabatic. There's a way for it not to be adiabatic, which is if you have, through the inflationary period, some second scalar field which is associated with some real quantum number, then that can kind of hold its own and not thermalize. And I could end up with fluctuations which don't take part in the, which don't get adiabatized in the same way. So there are two, we call one of them axions and we call one curvitons, and so you know, forgive me if this isn't what you thought of as an axion, but axions we think of as a thing which is separately quantized and can provide non-adiabatic fluctuations which will not be correlated with the distribution of the rest of the stuff. So what we're just really looking for is uncorrelated non-adiabatic modes. And we call those axions. It has axions would do that, but so would lots of other things. One reason to call them axions is that axions were proposed for very good reasons to exist, unlike so many of the dark matter candidates. What am I looking for here? But the result is we don't see a big signal from that axions. I think I cut out the part. Where are we here? I cut out the discussion of curvitons, which are the opposite end of that. So imagine a thing which is another scalar field and quantized and so forth, but whoever heard of it, doesn't exist for any particle physics reason, but is correlated with matter. So axions are uncorrelated and curvitons are just some made-up particle that is correlated. Neither of those exists at beyond the few percent level. So there should be gravitational radiation. Let me tell you the classic way people think of looking for the presence of gravitational radiation in the microwave background. Gravitational radiation provides a strain in space. So space will shrink in one direction and grow in the other. That provides a unique polarization signature in the microwave background. If you look at a hot spot and you ask how are the polarization lines arranged around it. If the lines either point right at the hot spot or circle it, then that pattern and its mirror image look the same. And those are called E modes, because one of them appears to be sort of divergence B. If you imagine a hot spot and you ask what the polarization lines do around it, and they point diagonally, That's opposite to its mirror image. And those are called B-modes. Lots of things can make E-modes in the polarization pattern, including gravitational radiation. But only gravitational radiation can make B-modes. So if you find B-modes, that must be gravitational radiation, not what we've done. It is the subject of future work. It's also true that gravitational radiation would provide a big bump, a boost in the anisotropy at low L. So we use our polarization data to sort of clean up the signal. And then we use measurement of the shape of the power spectrum to constrain how much of total boost there is. And so when we constrain R, the fraction of the energy density that's in gravitational radiation, it really comes from the shape. And so here's the thing. Now, this is initial spectral index and residual amount of power in gravitational radiation. And so what I'm saying, been saying in various ways all along, is that if I pick a model for how inflation happened, that the scalar potential is phi to the fourth or phi squared, and then I have to add a term to get the units back, that the more time you spend in inflation, the more you're driven to n equals 1 and no structure left. And so here's our error limits. And it looks like the simplest thing you could write down for inflationary potential isn't doing so incredibly well. The m squared phi squared, which is, I think, the first thing that people did write down seriously in the early inflation papers, is, you know, maybe right. There are separate reasons. This number here is the number of E-foldings between when the early structures that we see and came out and the end of inflation. And there's separate reasons to think that this number ought to be 50 or 60. So these are, I don't think there's a rule that says it can't be 80, but if you had asked the model makers how many E-foldings there were, they would have said 50 or 60. So the models do predict that we would lie in a place where there would be 10 or 15% of the energy density in gravitational radiation, and the spectral index would be 0.96. But the intriguing thing for me is spectral index of 1 is not favored by the data, and these error ellipses are small enough that you can write down models that are going to be right or wrong in this precision, and this is one of the things that grows linearly in time. So we have a decision next week for whether or not we can have 8 or 9 years of data instead of 5. And these error bars might shrink by almost a factor of 2 in size, so dramatically in area. Wouldn't it be cool if when they did, they lifted off the zero line, which would indicate a detection of gravitational radiation. But for that, I think WMAP is not the right experiment. Well, in here, I've timed it poorly because I should have come to neutrinos sooner. Here we go. Neutrinos decoupled, as I said, at a second. So the universe should have had quite different acoustic, I get a different acoustic snapshot. So there's a thing that is called in the literature anisotropic stress. The isotropy power spectrum of the neutrinos is different than the isotropy power spectrum of the rest of the stuff when it decoupled. And so gravitationally there should be some pull left from these neutrinos as they go on. It's easy to forget because two Kelvin neutrino background is no fraction at all of the present mass density. But at the time that photons decoupled, the 2 Kelvin neutrino background was about 10% of the mass density of the universe. So these used to be important, and they have a gravitational pull then. Here, I know it seems like not a huge effect, right? The blue curve is with no neutrinos, and the red curve is with the neutrinos. But that is what a 3-sigma effect looks like in these data. You know, I just apologize that it isn't better and a bigger effect. And then there's an effect out here, which you might see again, but not with our experiment, but with these little, small angular scale ground-based experiments. So this is the effect we've seen. Another way to describe it is that the number of effective number of neutrino species and the total amount of matter in the universe are almost what's the phrase for us? You know, redundant or completely confused. And so we do a good job of constraining that ratio and a poor job of constraining the total number of neutrino species. But in the last, so in previous analyses, these error circles just stayed in that ratio and came right down to zero, allowing total number of early relativistic neutrino species which decoupled to be zero. But we don't allow zero anymore. So if I plot a cross section through here of the likelihood values, then all we're saying is zero neutrinos decoupling at when the universe was a second isn't allowed anymore. No one in this room is surprised, is that right? And it's kind of funny, right, as I say here, we're consistent with the obvious correct answer. This is not the easiest way to measure how many neutrino species there are. But this is just the first look. This is the first time that there's an astronomical measurement of how many primordial neutrinos there are. I'll stop with that. I've run over time. One slide.
Okay. No. So if you add additional data on the right here, you know how much better the...
Here.
Yeah, from these small angular.
So shall I go to slide 7 or whatever to look at the additional data and we'll see if you think... Keep in mind that what we're... Right? There are a lot of experiments working very hard on this tail. Sorry.
Where was I?
No. I obviously don't have the slide ever memorized.
There's a new Princeton polarization term.
Here. Maybe this is what you want. So it's these curves here. And I guess what... Yeah? So if you just look at this one, you say, oh, okay, that shift that the neutrinos call for is favored. But then when I come down here, it's kind of not. Right? I would say, so that data set is the best one. I think it doesn't add tension to the neutrino mass, to the number of neutrinos. But in principle, this could. So a well-designed experiment working here, and there are a bunch, South Pole experiment, which, is, as you might guess, is at South Pole. ACT, Atacama Cosmology Telescope, is in the Atacama in northern Chile. There are a bunch of dedicated experiments working in this window, and that's probably the mundane thing that they'll find. You know, that's a sort of known target for them.
The SP is some lowest in the literature, but very low, and you have momenta like the universe having a rotational axis and these sort of things. Can you comment on that? L equal 1, L equal 2.
What?
L equal 1, L equal 2.
You know, I left those slides out. Very, very low. I start with a generic comment. We tracked how many goofy things we looked for in the data. So when we find goofy things, you know, patterns of why are, you know, 4 spherical harmonics in a row high or something like that, we know how many things we checked for. And so we can say, oh, well, we're finding about the number of goofy patterns in this supposedly Gaussian set that we should, given how many things we looked at. When someone else comes forward and says, look what I found, it's quite hard to say, oh, and how many places did you look? Or how many other people aren't coming forward who looked in other places and didn't find stuff. So it's quite hard to do the posteriori statistics. It is true that the lowest handful of L modes are lower than this model predicts. The odds of getting the L of 2, 3, and 4 as low as they are in the temperature spectrum, it's about 0.5%. That's been known since 1990 when COBE flew. You know, we're cosmic variance limited at L of 530, so COBE was already cosmic variance limited then. And our you know, very low L for ages. Our data are consistent with theirs. So if there was a convincing good physics explanation for how those things came about, I mean, there's been a 30-year window here or a 20-year window to come forward with that. I just think they're going to be, I mean, my own hunch, they're going to be things which are unlikely at the 0.5% level in this much data. There are also a bunch of alignments. The variance is different in the northern and southern hemispheres. And it's also, I think, sort of funny but true that the hottest spot in the microwave background, where's our, hottest spot in the microwave background, coldest spot in the microwave background are both covered by the galactic plane. But they are. I don't know. If it was true that L of 3 was weird, there's not a physics model for it that I'm aware of. And so I just end up thinking that that's just an unlikely event in our sky.
I listen to these stories about inflation, and I'm just amazed that we sort of accept it and believe in it, because you sort of start thinking about this expansion by 60 orders of magnitude in 10 to the minus 35 seconds or something, and then you think, you know, things have to move, right? Or is it that our description of time and distance changed there? Because otherwise...
Well, no, why do things have to move? Oh, no. Okay, this is the metric that's... What if I just, you know, we held a meeting and redefined the meter here? It's the things aren't, all objects in that universe feel as though they're at rest. They don't feel forces. Is that okay?
Yeah, that's okay, but I'm not sure what it means. As compared to what you're saying, then when things expand by...
The distance between objects grows.
But you have an expanded space in reality?
Yeah.
Where did the energy come from?
Yeah, there's a secret here. In many problems in physics, you say energy is total conserved. It does seem like our universe is a bit of a free lunch here. It is expanding.
I mean, it seems we replaced one problem. One problem with another one. And although you solved flatness and the horizon problem, I think you've introduced a different one.
I'm not sure. I don't think that's fair, actually. Char says that energy is conserved locally but not globally.
Yeah.
And this is just GR that says.
I'm not inventing any new physics here. This is just ordinary GR. We do seem to live in a regime in which the universe is expanding and in which that expansion is increasing. And so it does seem like there's a cosmological constant here. It's 70% of the energy density at the moment. And the way that comes about is that there's a fixed energy density for an empty cubic meter. So if I have an amount of stuff, and it's stuff, so it's atoms or axions or who knows what, photons, and I expand that by a factor of 1,000 in all directions, then I still have the same number of photons and neutrinos and so forth, so that total energy hasn't changed, but I have 10 to the 9 times as many cubic meters, so I have 10 to the 9 times as much energy from the energy per cubic meter, and that's now 70% of our energy density. And that energy, that total, grows as the universe grows. If I say an empty cubic meter has a certain amount of energy,
and the universe grows. I have more of that. And as Scott says, that I can say this without violating local energy conservation, but globally, obviously, I have more and more total energy. That's just where we live. That's not, we're not talking about inflation. That's just, do I understand where galaxies are, or how fast the universe is expanding today, and so forth. And I think that's near to inescapable. It's a easy part of general relativity. So I would need to reinvent a lot to not have that. I mean, may
well, yeah, maybe the problem is our knowledge of GR is about this much.
It's funny, right? So I mean, definitely, you know, you could flunk lots of relativists on a first year physics exam, where you would ask them, is energy always conserved and so forth? And you would get a bunch of answers, and you would say, who are these complete idiots? yeah.
Thanks.
Marcel.
You alluded to a couple of things. One was a big decision happening next week.
Oh, right.
I'd like to know what's going on there. And you also kept saying, this is not the experiment to do this, that, and the other thing.
Okay.
What is the experiment to do these other things?
Sure. So in let's start with what happens next week. So NASA, here we are flying. What we cost to keep operating is only whatever it costs to get the data. But that's not zero, because what happens is we negotiate with the satellite every day. It's overhead at midnight. We collect the data. We look at it, because if it's got 3 days of data, and if it's not, fine. So it costs us a few $1 million a year to keep running. There's a senior review panel which decides whether or not experiments can keep going. And they meet next week. So last time they met, we were approved to run through 6 years, which is what they had permission, and they recommended that we be allowed to run for 8. But so now the panel that decides if we can run to 8 years meets next week. They have about half as much money as they have people asking for money. So it's not at all guaranteed that we'll be allowed to continue. We're unbelievably cheap compared to things with more for real operating budgets, but it's not by any means guaranteed. And the committee doesn't seem to understand the niceties of linear versus square root growth in error bars and so on. It's the PI described this as the worst experience of his life the last couple times he went to this committee meeting. What other experiments are there?
Is there a plan, even if it's sketched, about what WMAP 2, son of WMAP?
No. Oh, okay. No. What other experiments are there? Is the following? If you want. To. Really see polarization, you would like a dedicated polarization experiment. I don't think anyone really knows how to do it, in the sense when we proposed to do WMAP, we had the receivers in hand, knew we had a systematic error budget. We said, if you give us the money, we will build this, it will work. So I don't think the field is at that stage yet. But there are many people proposing to build polarization experiments. The reason they should be a satellite is that this effect really is strongest at low L, that is whole sky. So I'd like a way of observing big chunks of the sky in polarization. There are a lot of small angular scale polarization experiments which might get a hint of this, and will certainly get evidence on foreground gravitational lensing and so on. So there's a big community in the US and in Canada studying how to build such a satellite, independently a big European community studying how to build it. But I would say no one has a drawing yet. And the mood is, here's WMAP and it works. There's a European satellite, Planck, which is going to be launched in the fall, which is again, it's a lot like Planck, but with smaller beams. And the mood is, a lot of other fields in astronomy would complain if we got the next satellite too. So probably the wrong mood for that. The smaller angular scale ripples, as I said, there are a couple of experiments that are sort of just starting now. So South Pole Telescope had its first season last year, only kind of barely works, but there you go. ACT, which is an experiment I'm part of, led by a group in at Princeton, built a telescope. Actually, it was built by Coast Steel in Coquitlam, and then put on a boat and shipped down to Chile. It's a 6-meter off-axis telescope. So it's the right way to measure out here. That had one season with one color camera last year, but we're shipping a three color camera down in a month. So there's a lot of work happening out here from the ground, which is where this should happen. This is the angular scale sort of typical ground-based telescopes are good at.
Okay, let's thank Mark again.
I didn't get a chance to ask my question.
Oh.